Welcome. I'm Chris Cowdley, and I'd like to thank you for joining us today for this educational activity titled Digging Deeper into Abnormal Liver Tests. This CME activity is supported by an educational grant from Gilead Sciences and Ipsen Biopharmaceuticals. CME Outfitters is a joint accreditation provider and develops and certifies continuing education activities for the team, by the team concept, including our program today. And during our program, we will disclose if an off-label use of a product or device is mentioned. So once again, my name is Chris Cowdley. I'm a professor at Elson S. Floyd College of Medicine, Washington State University, and director at Liver Institute Northwest in Seattle. And I'm very pleased to be joined today by two colleagues who I'll ask to introduce themselves, starting with Carolyn.
Thank you, Dr. Cowdley. Hi, everyone. My name is Carolyn Legaspi. I'm a nurse practitioner at Cedars-Sinai Medical Center in Los Angeles, and I work in hepatology and liver transplant.
Hello, everyone. My name is Dr. Monica Tinkopa. I'm an assistant professor at University of California, San Diego. I'm also a research investigator in the UCSD Maslow Research Center.
Thank you both. Looking forward to our conversation on two very timely and important topics today, and I hope you will enjoy the program and the work we put into it. Here are disclosures, and here are disclosures for the peer reviewers and the CME Outfitter staff. So here are learning objectives for this session. After participating in this activity on primary biliary cholangitis, PBC, metabolic dysfunction-associated steatotic liver disease, MASLD, and metabolic dysfunction-associated steatohepatitis, you should be better able to identify signs and symptoms, implement team-based strategies for early and accurate diagnosis, and assess new and emerging therapeutic pathways which impact treatment decision-making. So the title of our program is Digging Deeper into Abnormal Liver Tests. To start, let's look at an overview of liver function tests, as we call them, with predictive value in practice. So for example, we know liver tests are invaluable tools in medicine, and you as internists use them every single day. They can be very straightforward, or they can be quite confusing, depending on the particular situation that you're dealing with. They can be predictive as a true function test, for example, tests that measure synthetic liver function, such as albumin, bilirubin, prothrombin time, or INR, and they can also have diagnostic value. So, for example, informed by a proper history, we can recognize clinical patterns that might point to a hepatocellular form of liver dysfunction, a cholestatic form of liver dysfunction, with the former being characterized by predominant elevation of aminotransferases, the latter by predominant elevation of alkaline phosphatase and gamma GT. We also very frequently in clinical practice see patients who have isolated total bilirubin elevation. And of course, many of these patients have Gilbert syndrome. That is not a clinically meaningful disorder, but we're frequently asked to consult, particularly in patients who are post-operative. And then we sometimes see isolated liver test abnormalities that may or may not have clinical significance. So one of the things that we hope will be accomplished in this session is a better understanding of how do we characterize patients into cholestatic and hepatocellular forms of dysfunction. How do we recognize patterns that are associated with metabolic dysfunction-related liver disease, which we now call MASLD, particularly in the context of other metabolic syndrome risk factors? How do we interpret a ultrasound report that may or may not be clear? Sometimes radiologists try to be helpful and say the liver has cirrhosis because it's nodular or has fatty change because it's echogenic, but these are imaging features and not diagnoses. So we have to learn how to differentiate what we read from what we are actually dealing with. And similarly, I think recognizing somewhat more uncommon liver disorders, but disorders that we can diagnose as internists, such as primary biliary cholangitis, drug-related liver injury, and other disorders, I think will hold us in good stead. And hopefully at the end of this session, we will have a better recognition of what is the domain in which we can comfortably make a diagnosis, maybe risk assess the patient, and then work with a specialist for staging and specific therapy. So let's start with PBC. Carolyn, please take us through our first case.
All right. Thank you so much, Dr. Cadley. I'm very excited today to be joining you for a talk on liver disease. We're going to start off with a patient case on PBC. So our patient, Maggie, is a 50-year-old advertising account executive. Around 2021, she visited her primary care physician's office for complaints of persistent fatigue and complaints of mouth itching that mostly occur at night. Her lab values were noted for an elevated alkaline phosphatase at 380. Maggie's PCP attributed her symptoms and elevated alkaline phosphatase to nonspecific causes like aging and stress, and unfortunately didn't pursue further diagnostic tests or recommended a hepatology referral. Over the course of the next few years, her symptoms worsened. By 2025, her fatigue was very severe, and the pruritus was really impacting her quality of life. So Maggie sought out care from a specialist and was diagnosed with PBC and advanced fibrosis at that time. Now she's facing challenges of managing liver disease and potential complications. So we wanted to pose a question and get some audience participation. Based on this clinic case presentation, which of the following tests would have been a guideline-recommended first step towards an earlier diagnosis? Anti-nuclear antibody, anti-mitochondrial antibody, anti-glycoprotein 210, or anti-speckled protein 100, a liver biopsy, or I'm not sure. Perfect. So the correct answer is anti-mitochondrial antibody. So we're going to start off with what is PBC and kind of defining what PBC is. PBC is a chronic cholestatic autoimmune disease, and it occurs due to progressive destruction of the small bile ducts in the liver, which can eventually lead to cirrhosis. The rate of progression varies among individuals, where some lucky patients never develop fibrosis and others will eventually need liver transplantation. In histological studies of PBC patients without treatment, the average histological change progresses one stage over about 1.5 years. After 4 years, the probability of remaining in the early stage of PBC was about 30%, while cirrhosis was diagnosed in 50% of patients who initially had no fibrosis. Like many autoimmune diseases, the exact cause of PBC is unknown, but is attributed to environmental triggers and genetic predisposition. So most, we call this a common rare disease because most clinicians will encounter PBC, although it is a fairly rare autoimmune disorder. Some clinical patient profiles, mostly seen in women, and it occurs or can develop in their fifth or sixth decade of life. And more rarely, it does occur in men. About 10% of cases occur in men. Unfortunately, often that presents with advanced liver disease and worse prognosis. We have seen an increase in global prevalence of PBC, although in North America and Europe, there has been a decrease in patients that have needed liver transplantation for PBC. So hopefully this is a sign that we're recognizing this earlier and due to developments in treatment options, we're able to treat patients before they get to the point where they are needing liver transplant. So how are patients presenting in clinic? What do they complain of? Fatigue is reported in up to 80% of patients. It's very severe. It's not the normal fatigue that you would have. It's severe enough that they're looking for an explanation for why their fatigue is occurring. And it can be very nonspecific for patients who are coming in. That's probably a very common reason why patients are seeking care. But pruritus is without a rash has been reported to affect about 20 to 70% of patients. In advanced cases, you might see ascites or esophageal varices, hepatic encephalopathy in patients who have developed cirrhosis related to the PBC and are now decompensated. Some autoimmune disorders that are associated with PBC or we see them occur together are Sjogren's and Raynaud's. Patients can also present asymptomatically. So they come to the office for their annual physical and they're flagged by having abnormal liver enzymes. So this should raise suspicion and further evaluation should be taken. So diagnosis is critical to prevent, you know, liver sequelae with regards to cirrhosis and liver failure and hopefully preventing death and liver transplantation. Sometimes it can take patients years to receive a diagnosis because, again, the symptoms are very nonspecific. But hopefully today we'll be able to give you guidance on how to diagnose this. There are many different specialists that are involved in the care of taking care of PBC patients. The first person that will probably notice patients have a change in their symptoms or abnormalities in their liver enzymes are generally their PCP. From there, they may get referred over to their GI or hepatologist, and then we rely really heavily on our radiologists and pathologists for diagnostics. When and if they have more advanced disease, then it becomes very multidisciplinary. We get the surgeons involved, nutritionists and social worker, if they're at that point where they're going to need a liver transplant. This slide is just a diagnostic pathway for PBC. If you have suspicion for PBC and the patient presents with an elevated alkaline phosphatase, generally the alkaline phosphatase is 1.5 times the upper limit of normal. That would be, and you have a positive AMA, that would be diagnostic for PBC. Obviously, you want to rule out other causes for cholestasis, including medications, you know, order an abdominal ultrasound, common things being common, like gallstones, cholecystitis, getting a good family history, because, again, there is genetic predisposition for this autoimmune disorder. So if you have an alkaline phosphatase that's 1.5 times the upper limit of normal and a positive AMA, that's diagnostic for PBC. Your job is done. If it's negative, there are other autoimmune markers that you can order, the GP210 and the SP100. If either one of those are positive, then that's specific for PBC and diagnostic for PBC. Now, if those autoimmune markers are also negative and you still have a suspicion for PBC, then we do recommend a liver biopsy to see if there's histological findings of PBC. There is a, you know, AMA negative PBC. You can also consider MRCP to rule out other differential diagnoses like PSC, IgG4 disease, and a genetic panel to rule out PFIC. So this just lays out the diagnostic criteria from the AASLD guidelines. Two of the three must be met, either an elevated alkaline phosphatase, the presence of a positive AMA, or other autoimmune markers like the SP100 or GP210 that we discussed. If the AMA is negative and you proceed with a liver biopsy, then the liver biopsy should show evidence of destruction of the interlobular bile ducts. So we're going to move on to the next question. Which of the following treatments for PBC have shown significant biochemical response as well as improvement in pruritus? Elafibranor, obeticholic acid, seladelpar, both A and C, or you don't know.
I'm pretty impressed with the responses because I'm not sure that many gastroenterologists would have just had such a high rate of correct answers. So that's really remarkable. So for the people that may not have been aware of what's going on, it's been a pretty exciting time in treatment of PBC. I've been involved in treating PBC really since my fellowship days, and ursodeoxycholic acid was approved in 1998-1999 and remained the only therapy until 2016. Obeticholic acid was approved as second-line therapy, and just in the last year, we've had two new agents approved also for second-line therapy. So this is a really exciting time. From a management perspective, what's really attractive about PBC is because a liver biopsy is not required for diagnosis, really any of us can confirm the diagnosis, as you accurately mentioned in the audience response question, just with a positive anti-mitochondrial antibody at sufficiently high titer, or a disease-specific ANA, which is the SP100 or GP210 antibodies to ANA. And these are available in PBC panels that are available from large commercial labs. And you can also get an immunofluorescence-based assay, which gives you a more specific titer for the anti-mitochondrial antibody. So once you've made the diagnosis, really all you need to do is stage the patient. And we now have the ability with magnetic resonance elastography or vibration-controlled transient elastography to stage the patient without a biopsy again. So really, it's within completely within the skill set and resources of an internist to diagnose and even start treatment for PBC. So historically, we've set that the standard is to initiate ursodeoxycholic acid, which is a hydrophilic, water-soluble bile acid, normally present in human bile, and it's present at about 4%. And we're essentially enriching the bile with URSO, and it has a non-specific effect of reducing the acid concentration of bile, increasing the water content, promoting bile flow, and it's essentially a non-specific flush, if you will. And the major advance that happened 8 years ago was the recognition that alkaline phosphatase, after 1 year of treatment with ursodeoxycholic acid, provides very important information about long-term prognosis. And patients who have persistently elevated alkaline phosphatase after a sufficient trial of URSO or an elevated bilirubin at any level are at increased risk of needing a liver transplant or dying of liver disease over the next 15 years. So assessing the response is something that we can do using online calculators such as the GLOBE score or the UK PBC score. These are free. You can bookmark it on your computer and evaluate the patient's risk from that information. So once you've assessed the response, you then determine, has the patient responded adequately or not? And that would be with a significant improvement, ideally normalization of alkaline phosphatase. We don't care that much about gamma GT. It's nice if it's reduced. It's great if it's normal, but it's not as important from a prognostic standpoint. And then if the patient has not responded, that's where we would then consider the patient to be a candidate for second-line therapy. And until last year, our options were obeticholic acid, which has some liabilities because it causes pruritus and it's contraindicated in patients with advanced cirrhosis. We also had off-label option of treating with fibrates, fenofibrate being the main fibrate available in the U.S., which poses challenges because it has a black box warning for liver and kidney disease, and to treat a patient with liver disease with such a drug, you know, always raises concerns. But that's where we were, and if the patient had a response, you would monitor them, and if they didn't have a response, you could consider clinical trials. So we needed new treatments because URSO fails to work for about 40% of patients. About 10% of patients are intolerant due to GI disorders. Those who are non-responders have a five-fold increased progression to cirrhosis and a three-fold increase in age-adjusted mortality. This is really important and maybe the most important takeaway message from this session today, which is it's not always obvious when you're seeing two patients in your office. One patient has a risk of being free of transplant at 15 years of 75%, another patient only 25%, and the differences in their laboratory tests may not seem that different unless you recognize what the cutoffs are for alkaline phosphatase and bilirubin. And of course, the adverse events associated with URSO has limited the use of this medication for many patients. Obeticholic acid, as I mentioned, was approved in 2016, but it has some challenges being a hydrophobic bile acid, and therefore it accumulates in patients with advanced disease. And after the drug was approved, we discovered that some patients with decompensated cirrhosis or clinically significant portal hypertension were at risk for worsening on obeticholic acid. And the main challenge is that a significant proportion of patients develop itch or pruritus on OCA, which is a challenge when you have a population of patients that already suffers from itch. So this posed some limitations, and so there was a need for second-line therapy. So two agents have been developed and were approved last year, elafibranor and seladelpar. They're PPAR agonists, so they're peroxisome proliferator-activated receptor agonists. These are nuclear hormone receptors that are in the liver, and by binding to these receptors, there's a variety of different effects that are anti-inflammatory, anti-cholestatic, and anti-fibrotic. And elafibranor is a dual PPAR alpha-delta agonist, was approved in June last year, and seladelpar is a pure PPAR delta agonist, approved in August of last year. So here are the results, and 44% of you already knew this, which was remarkable, but when you see the biochemical response in the population treated with elafibranor compared to placebo, you can see on the upper left, 51% achieved the biochemical response we were looking for, which is a reduction in alkaline phosphatase to less than 1.67 times upper limit of normal and maintaining a normal bilirubin, compared to only 4% with placebo, so a 47% placebo-corrected response. What is particularly attractive about these new drugs is we're starting to see normalization of alkaline phosphatase. And as a hepatologist, we've been treating autoimmune hepatitis for years. We're treating hepatitis C, and we want to see all the liver tests become normal, and this has not been possible in PBC until recently. So 15% of patients achieved normal alkaline phosphatase, and you can see that there's a prompt response and about a 40% reduction in alkaline phosphatase. What's particularly attractive is these drugs appear to show a favorable effect on pruritus or itch as opposed to worsening of itch as we saw with obeticholic acid. So we saw in patients with PBC in whom UDCA did not achieve our treatment goal, treatment with elafibranor led to greater improvements in relevant biochemical indicators of cholestasis compared to placebo and a potential trend towards improved pruritus, and the adverse events were generally infrequent and well tolerated, and these are predominantly GI related. What's even more attractive is we have some data that's emerging from long-term open-label treatment with elafibranor, and we're seeing potential improvements in fatigue, with fatigue and pruritus being the two most vexing symptoms for PBC patients, and fatigue being a symptom for which we really haven't had effective therapies. And what we're seeing here, with the caveat being this is open-label treatment, so we don't have a placebo comparison, but with continued treatment, you're seeing clinically meaningful improvements in fatigue with elafibranor with treatment up to 3 years. And so this is exciting, and if that is borne out, it would mean that we potentially could not only modify the disease, but also relieve symptoms or improve symptoms. Now, seladelpar is the PPAR delta agonist, and here you saw a 61.7% response with the same criteria in the treated patients compared to 20% in placebo. So here, the placebo response was higher, and the placebo-corrected response, again, very similar at about 42%. And here we saw 25% of patients actually achieving alkaline phosphatase normalization. And with seladelpar, we actually saw a statistically significant improvement in itch at 6 months that was maintained up to 12 months. And you can see that the side effects of seladelpar, similar to other drugs in this class, predominantly GI-related, with an acceptable rate of serious adverse events, and a prompt and brisk reduction in alkaline phosphatase after starting therapy that's maintained. Now, we're seeing some similar long-term data with open-label treatment with seladelpar that were just presented at our liver meeting last fall. And you can see in the middle graph in the bottom, improvement in pruritus that continued to show benefit with patients reporting at a reasonably high rate, no or minimal pruritus that was almost subclinical. And for the first time, we're seeing reduced incidence of new pruritus in patients who were treated. So we're able to not only mitigate pruritus, but possibly prevent the development of pruritus along with the desired biochemical response we've been looking for. So with that, I'm going to turn to MASLD and MASH and ask Dr. Tinkopa to take us through that.
So this is going to be a case that's very relevant. I'm sure it comes up all the time in your practice. We have a 61-year-old person who's an auto service supervisor. In terms of relevant past medical history, they have type 2 diabetes, dyslipidemia, hypertension. They do also have central adiposity with a BMI of 32.7. They self-report having a high-carb diet and state that they have, on average, 5 to 7 alcoholic drinks per week. They do have a chief complaint of some vague abdominal discomfort, mostly in the right upper quadrant. In terms of medications, they're currently taking metformin, valsartan, and hydrochlorothiazide. These are their labs. So you can see that the ALT is elevated at 60, the AST is elevated at 65. We have a normal alkaline phosphatase, the total bilirubin is 1.4. Albumin normal, platelets 180. You can see their lipid profile here and that their A1C is 7.1. So let's talk a little bit about what is MASLD and MASH. So it used to be non-alcoholic fatty liver disease, or NAFLD, and non-alcoholic steatohepatitis. Relatively recently, we changed the nomenclature, one, to eliminate stigma, and two, instead of being an exclusionary diagnosis, to really focus on the fact that the pathogenesis relies on metabolic dysfunction. So now it is MASLD and MASH. So the definition of MASLD, so you have to have, by definition, steatosis, generally speaking, of at least 5%. You have to have minimal alcohol use, which there's a lot of discussion about exactly what that means and the accuracy of self-report. You cannot have any other etiology of liver disease and no other secondary causes of having fat buildup in the liver. Why is this relevant? Well, the global prevalence of MASLD is about 30% among all adults, so it's a very significant problem. And it's just projected to continue to rise in the setting of increasing rates of obesity, type 2 diabetes, and metabolic syndrome. And here are two pictures, if you were to get a liver biopsy, what it would look like. So the first picture here is just showing MASLD. So you have steatosis, but you don't have actual liver cell damage. On the other side, however, this is representing MASH. So MASH, you have the steatosis, but you also have direct liver cell damage that can be in the form of ballooned hepatocytes, inflammation, and ultimately what is most important clinically is fibrosis. So as I stated, the global prevalence of MASLD is very high, about 30%, but it also varies substantially in subgroups. So among patients with type 2 diabetes, it's as high as 56%, some studies as high as 66%. So very, very prevalent among individuals with type 2 diabetes. The prevalence of MASH is much lower, so ranging anywhere between 1.5 to 6.5, but again, higher among individuals with type 2 diabetes. So if you take all of the adults in the United States, roughly 20% of them will have MASH. In general, it's thought to be a slowly progressive disease, but because it's asymptomatic, many individuals will have it for decades and have no idea until they present with decompensated liver disease. So as you can see, over time, you can develop fibrosis, ultimately leading to cirrhosis, liver failure with need for liver transplantation. There is also a risk for hepatocellular carcinoma, even in patients who don't have cirrhosis, but perhaps advanced fibrosis.
The important thing to highlight here, however, is it's not the leading cause of death in these individuals. So the number one cause of death in an individual with MASH is cardiovascular disease, and you can imagine that's because of the metabolic dysfunction associated with this condition. The number two cause of death is cancer, and that has to relate with the fact that a lot of features of metabolic syndrome increase your risk for a number of different types of cancer. And it's not until you get to the third leading cause of death that is actually a primary liver condition in these individuals. So what are the populations at risk in terms of prompting who should you be screening for this? So anyone with overweight and obesity with any metabolic risk factor. And what's this trying to show here is as you increase the number of risk factors you have, the likelihood of an individual having advanced fibrosis goes up. So again, an individual with type 2 diabetes has a much higher likelihood of having advanced fibrosis than somebody who perhaps only has overweight or obesity. And as I said, these patients are often asymptomatic, so they have no idea that they have this condition. Most often, we'll find it incidentally. You order labs for some other indication, you'll see that the liver enzymes are elevated, or you order imaging for some other indication, and the radiologist will just note, oh, there's hepatic steatosis. Some patients do report some vague right upper quadrant pain and fatigue, but the vast majority of individuals are asymptomatic. So how do we risk stratify patients? There are a long list of different options for non-invasive testing. So our first question, you and Walter agree to screen for MASLD. Which of the following is the next step for risk stratification? Fibrosis 4, so Fib4 index, liver biopsy, a magnetic resonance elastography, or MRE, a transient elastography, most often referred to as a FibroScan, or I don't know. Very interesting. So 44% of you picked Fib4, 42% of you said FibroScan. So let's get into it. So what is a Fib4? So Fib4 is a non-invasive way, essentially uses your age and then some fairly basic serologic markers. So you need age, AST, ALT, and a platelet count. Using those variables, it'll give you a score and put you into one of three buckets: low risk, indeterminate, or high risk. The cut point to know is 1.3. So if it's less than 1.3, essentially you're ruling out advanced fibrosis. If it's greater than 2.67, the likelihood of having advanced fibrosis is pretty significantly high. There is something else called the NFS, or NAFLD fibrosis score. In clinical practice and research, we don't use it very often, just because, as you can see, you need a lot more data points in order to do this risk calculation. But for you to know, this other risk calculator does exist. This is the updated guidance from ASLD in terms of who we should be screening and how do we risk stratify. So a few years ago, we didn't actually recommend screening anyone, in large part because the prevalence was so high and we didn't have any liver-directed therapies. Now that we do have liver-directed therapy, we have a very clear guidance in terms of who we should be screening and how we should be screening them. So as you can see here, the correct answer was Fib4. So if somebody has metabolic risk factors, you can screen them. If you want to know what their likelihood of having advanced liver disease is, you start with a Fib4, which again, you can get using very basic laboratory studies that are very often ordered in primary care. And then that puts you into your buckets. If you are in the indeterminate zone, which is somewhat of a problem in Fib4, because 30% of people, it'll give you an indeterminate score, then you go on to the second test. What is the second test? You have two options. Option one is a FibroScan, or what we refer to as VCTE. Option two is something called ELF, which is a proprietary send-out test. So this is that score I was talking about. It's a blood test, but you do have to send it out. The access is not as great, and sometimes you can have difficulty with insurance coverage. But it is an option, and same thing, it puts you into one of three buckets: low, medium, or high risk. So elastography, we kind of live and breathe this at UC San Diego because we do a lot of MRI. But there are a lot of different options, and it's very exciting. So the thought is that elastography measures stiffness of the liver. And the stiffness of the liver is a surrogate for fibrosis. So the more fibrosis you have in the liver, the stiffer your liver is. So VCTE, or FibroScan, is most commonly used because it's an ultrasound-based test. It's more widely available in the community. You do need multiple images, and it's very accurate for ruling out having advanced fibrosis. You can also get a second data point depending on whether or not the machine has it, called a CAP score, and that will give you separate information about how much fat buildup is in the liver. There are other ultrasound-based tests, shear-wave elastography, or ARFI. People like this because you can get your standard ultrasound images plus a fibrosis assessment. The most accurate way to stage steatosis and fibrosis without a biopsy, however, are MRI-based measures. They don't have a lot of issues with the confounders that the ultrasound-based measures have. And instead of having one point of assessment, which is what you get with an ultrasound, MRI gets a global view. So what you're trying to see in this image here is it'll give you a heat map of stiffness, and then it gives you the average of that. So say one part of the liver is stiffer than another. If you do a FibroScan, you may only get that assessment, whereas MRI-based parameters can give you a holistic assessment of fat buildup and scarring. So this is just some data going over FibroScan in terms of like what the cut points are and what the likelihood of degree of fibrosis is. And so essentially, as you go up in the liver stiffness measurement, that increases the likelihood of having a lot of scarring of the liver. And the reason that this is important is that the studies have shown is as you increase in the amount of fibrosis, that increases your risk of liver-related mortality and overall mortality. And so the important thing to know is once you get to stage 2 fibrosis, that's where your risk really increases. As I said, there's a number of different non-invasive tests or NIATs for MASLD and MASH. As I said, this is kind of the trade-off between accuracy and kind of cost-effectiveness and accessibility. So MRI-based ones, most accurate, most expensive, and least accessible. And as you go down, you have the ultrasound-based measures, and kind of the first pass are just these serologic risk calculations like the FIB4. All right, now I'm going to hand it back off to Dr. Cowley to go over treatment.
Thank you, Monica. That was great. So I think the key point from our standpoint as internists and hepatologists is really to differentiate the importance of staging. And the reason it's important is that patients who have MASH or MASLD but have stage 0 or 1 fibrosis in the liver are at increased risk of cardiovascular death, stroke, et cetera, but not of increased risk of liver-related death. And it's stage 2 fibrosis is when that increases and dramatically increases at stage 3. And by the time a patient has reached stage 4 or cirrhosis, they have a 30 to 40-fold higher risk of dying of a liver-related death compared to patients who don't have advanced fibrosis. So the staging is really a key part of what we are doing as hepatologists to try to risk stratify those 90 million people that have MASLD. So what are our treatment options? Well, clearly weight loss plays a critical role, and a randomized placebo-controlled trial that is now a seminal study that was done in Cuba by Villar Gomez, who is now in Indiana, showed that in patients who were randomized to weight loss compared to not weight loss, you could see that there was a sort of a linear relationship between the amount of weight loss and the benefit. So to reduce steatosis, you need just a 3% weight loss. To reduce inflammation, you need about a 5% weight loss. 7% weight loss is associated with resolution of steatohepatitis, and 10% weight loss or more is associated with a one-stage reduction in fibrosis stage, which was seen in about 40% of patients. So weight loss remains sort of the cornerstone or the backbone of treatment. And all of our clinical trials with all pharmaceutical therapies, we're still emphasizing lifestyle modification. There's a tremendous amount of interest in diet, intermittent fasting, time-restricted eating, and also the constitution of the diet, with Mediterranean diet being sort of the one that we seem to recommend more often. But protein intake cannot be reinforced because patients who have obesity-related metabolic syndrome-related steatohepatitis have sarcopenia, and when they lose weight, especially with a GLP-1, if they're on a GLP-1 and if they have advanced fibrosis, sarcopenia is something that we're concerned about. But weight loss remains a backbone for all of these therapies. And then we've been trying to develop pharmacotherapeutic agents now for 20 years, and I've been involved in a lot of these trials, and it's been frustrating. We've had a lot of challenges in finding significant improvement, and there are a lot of methodologic reasons, technical reasons. This is a complex trait. It's not going to be easy to find one size fits all, but I'm pleased to report that as of last year, March, so 1 year ago roughly, we have a new therapy that is now FDA approved for treating metabolic associated steatohepatitis, metabolic dysfunction associated steatohepatitis called resmetirom. And this is a thyroid hormone beta receptor agonist. So there are beta receptors in the liver for thyroid hormone. And we've known for quite some time that the liver in patients who have MASH is functionally hypothyroid. And so by binding to this receptor, you can essentially increase the metabolic activity in the liver, and that's associated with significant reduction in liver fat, but also significant reduction in fibrosis by one stage and resolution of steatohepatitis. There's clearly a lot of interest in the role of incretin-based therapies such as GLP-1s, GLP-GIPs, and we're studying GLP-1 glucagon agonists, which is particularly attractive from my point of view because the liver has glucagon receptors, whereas GLP-1 receptors are not present in the liver. And so there is emerging data, mainly in phase 2 trials and in one phase 3 trial, that GLP-1s may also lead to resolution of steatohepatitis and one-stage improvement in fibrosis. So there are a lot of therapeutic options, and we now have one drug that is actually FDA-approved to treat MASH. So this is a very exciting time, and I think we've seen the impact clearly of GLP-1s on the population at large. So where's the future and where's the present? So clearly we have a challenge because for many of us having access to dietitian or nutrition counseling is challenging unless the patient has diabetes or is being evaluated for a liver transplant, but it remains critical to have nutritional assessment, dietary modification, lifestyle modification as part of the management of MASH. FIB4 is an excellent tool in the primary care setting because it was really designed to exclude patients with advanced fibrosis. But bear in mind that FIB4 takes into account age. So a much older patient may have a falsely high FIB4 because they're older, and a younger patient may have a falsely low FIB4 because their age is low, even though they have advanced fibrosis. But clearly, this is the internal medicine disease because we're talking about hypertension, diabetes, sleep apnea, lipid management, and weight management. We have to partner with all of you and all of us to really make this this disease manageable because it is really is a global worldwide epidemic. And throughout the world, with the exception of sub-Saharan Africa, we're seeing prevalence of fatty liver disease of about 25-35% and seeing dramatic increases in our MASH rates. So here are the resmetirom data, and you can see that when you compare to placebo, there was a significant improvement in fibrosis as well as resolution of steatohepatitis. But as you can see, although these are promising results and attractive because you saw both improvement in MASH and fibrosis, we still have 3 out of 4 patients needing additional therapies. But there's a dramatic active landscape, and so I would encourage all of you to recommend referring a patient for clinical trial because we currently have therapies that are looking at incretin-based therapies in combination, but in particular, a class of drugs called FGF21 analogs have shown great promise with one compound achieving a almost 40% reversal of cirrhosis after 2 years of therapy in a study that was just announced in a press release and hopefully will be presented. And there are multiple different FGF21 analogs that are currently in clinical trials. And there are a variety of different pathways targeting inflammation, targeting altered lipid metabolism, fibrosis, and whatnot that are currently in late-stage clinical trials. So that brings us to sort of the end of our didactic portion of this talk. But before we start the Q&A, and we have several really useful and interesting Q&As, questions that I think will be useful to the audience, let's talk about the SMART goals. And these are specific, measurable, attainable, relevant, and timely to put this information into action. So please consider the following goals and set a time frame that fits with your work environment and a reasonable improvement target that aligns with the patient population. And the goals would be to increase the percentage of patients screened for PBC who present with elevated liver tests, increase the percentage of patients with abnormal liver tests where we are actually making a confirmed diagnosis, and then increase the percentage of patients treated for these conditions using available therapies. So with that, we'll go to the Q&A. The first question I'm going to ask Carolyn, a very practical question. What's the difference between primary biliary cholangitis and primary sclerosing cholangitis, and how do you tell the two apart?
Sure. So PBC is an autoimmune disorder of the small bile ducts, so we kind of talked about diagnosis for that. PSC is a diagnosis or an autoimmune disorder of the large bile ducts. So you would be able to see abnormalities in the bile ducts on an MRCP with PSC. You would not be able to see that with PBC. So it's a matter of small versus large bile ducts. Generally, PSC, you see this with associated with inflammatory bowel disease. So our patients have Crohn's and ulcerative colitis. Those coincide. And with PBC, you see the autoimmune associated with Sjogren's. So one is diagnostic from the anti-mitochondrial antibody with PBC and an elevated alkaline phosphatase, while PSC is also an elevated alkaline phosphatase. It's also a cholestatic disease, but you can diagnose it based off of imaging.
Yeah, so although they seem very similar, the anti-mitochondrial antibody is only seen in PBC. I have never seen a patient that had PSC that had a positive AMA, and PSC is very commonly associated with inflammatory bowel disease and has a slightly higher male-to-female predilection, whereas PBC is 90% women, although it is important to keep in mind that 10% of the patients are men, so we should not exclude that consideration. So I'm going to stick with Carolyn here for a second very practical question. Anti-mitochondrial antibody is a cheap test. Why don't we just order in any patient with abnormal liver tests? Should we be doing that? What are your thoughts?
I don't think so. I would disagree that you would just across the board order it for all of patients that are coming into your office, although it's an inexpensive test. Really, the threshold is if you see an isolated elevated alkaline phosphatase 1.5 times the upper limit of normal, that would prompt you to order the anti-mitochondrial antibody.
Great. Yeah, I think we see a lot of patients that are referred for a positive AMA. And remember that the AMA test that we get now is an ELISA assay. So you're just getting a number. And you, as you may remember, when you get the report, it will say less than 20 is negative, 20 to 25 is equivocal, 25 and higher is considered positive. But you have to interpret in the context of the patient. So if you have a patient with metabolic syndrome, elevated aminotransferases, normal alkaline phosphatase, and a low positive PBC, a low positive AMA, it's very unlikely to be PBC. Whereas if you have a patient with a cholestatic pattern, elevated alkaline phosphatase, gamma GT, patients of women, and has a titer of AMA with a number of 60 or 70, that's very likely to be positive. But those are the patients where you can order these PBC-specific panels. Another really good question was, you showed us that the results, that you should, after 1 year of ursodeoxycholic acid therapy, you should then make a decision about whether the patient is a candidate for second-line treatment. Why do we need to wait 1 year? Monica, what are your thoughts?
I think a lot of it has to do with what was done in the clinical trials, and it's shown that patients who eventually do respond to ursodiol, it just takes some time. So it's not that if you tested earlier, you'll have a good sense as to whether or not that medication alone is sufficient to treat them. It's just a slowly acting medication. So generally speaking, based on clinical trial data and the natural history of patients, a lot of patients eventually do respond. It's just not right away.
Yeah, and it's a very timely question because it's now clear that you can tell by 6 months which patient is likely to respond or not, depending on their alkaline phosphatase trajectory. So if they're still greater than 1.9 or 2 times upper limit of normal 6 months after starting ursodeoxycholic acid, then they're very unlikely to achieve your treatment goal, and we're starting to incorporate getting these patients into treatment earlier. But as Monica mentioned, it's really a historical artifact that we waited a year to determine the maximum response a patient is going to get and then consider second-line therapy. Another question for you, Monica, was what about the role of FibroScan, and how often should we be doing FibroScan or sending patients for FibroScan who have PBC?
Who have PBC?
Yeah.
So in general, we use FibroScan when you're concerned that a patient may potentially have advanced fibrosis. And so it's a very good test to try and rule that out. So if there's an individual who, based on their labs, based on their FIB4, you can calculate a FIB4 and PBC also, if it's elevated at that point, that's generally speaking when we would say a FibroScan may be helpful to better risk stratify them.
Great. So there's a question here about statins and liver tests and worsening glucose tolerance, how that might be affecting fibrosis. Let's just stop and just discuss the issue of statins and liver toxicity. Very, very common question. So, Monica, I'm going to stick to you on this one. What are your thoughts? What do you advise your primary care colleagues when they call you and say, I have a patient with elevated liver enzymes who's on a statin? Is it hepatotoxicity? What makes you think that it could be hepatotoxicity versus not?
So we get most concerned that perhaps a statin is causing an elevation in liver enzymes either at initiation or dose escalation. So if one of those two things relatively recently happened, then it goes higher in my list. But generally, you have to say, okay, what else may be also contributing? Obviously, a lot of these patients have risk factors for MASLD and MASH. Have they been evaluated for that? What does the imaging show? And so drug-induced liver injury is a diagnosis of exclusion. You have to make sure that there's nothing else going on that may also be contributing. But the most common thing that gets done when somebody is referred to me for elevated liver enzymes is their statin is stopped. And most of the time, I would say it's very unlikely that that's the cause because they've been on the same agent at the same dose for a very long time.
Yeah. You want to add anything, Carolyn?
Yeah, I just wanted to say that we get this question a lot. And as we discussed for MASLD, cardiovascular disease is, you know, the number one risk for mortality for these patients, even though they have fatty liver. So we want to keep them on their statin if possible. So we try to encourage our PCPs to rule out everything else before we stop their statin.
Yeah, I mean, I think the take-home message is probably a true unrelated situation. If a patient on a statin, they're probably on a statin because they have some features of metabolic syndrome. They have elevated liver enzymes, probably driven by MASLD, not by the statin. But usually statin-related liver injury, the enzymes go up very high and within the first 3 to 6 months and usually 3 months of starting the statin. It does occur, but it's quite rare. I'll take a couple of questions here about, I mentioned that in sub-Saharan Africa, MASLD MASH is less common. And why is that? Well, we now know that there are several genes that play a key role in modifying metabolic syndrome and steatohepatitis. And one of the most important ones is a gene called PNPLA3. And the GG, heterozygote or homozygote, genotype is associated with a higher rate of developing fatty liver disease in patients who have metabolic syndrome, a higher rate of developing steatohepatitis, and a higher rate of developing cirrhosis, and in patients who drink alcohol to excess, higher rate of developing alcoholic cirrhosis or alcohol-related cirrhosis. So that genotype is more common in people who are Mexican-American or Asian and less common in people who are Black. So that seems to be a really one important genetic modifier that could potentially drive this, and potentially there are others. There's a question here about what is the mechanism of fatigue and pruritus in PBC. And the short answer is we're not exactly sure. Pruritus has been linked to elevated serum bile acids, but patients are identified who have significant pruritus who don't have elevated bile acids, and patients who have high bile acids who don't have pruritus. But there is a complex neurohormonal visceral sensation of pruritus. Undoubtedly, it's related to some degree to increased bile acid synthesis and reduced bile acid excretion, but how much bile acids are directly related is unclear, There's a new class of drugs called IBAT inhibitors, ileal bile acid transport inhibitors, that actually block enterohepatic circulation by blocking reabsorption of bile acids in the terminal ileum, and they appear very promising in treating pruritus. With seladelpar, an interesting observation was that IL-31, which is a known biomarker and a known associated cytokine for several dermatologic diseases, was reduced in patients who were treated with seladelpar, and there are biologics that are actually used to treat severe pruritus from dermatologic conditions that modulate IL-31. So I think we'll have time for one more question, and it's a good one. It's for Monica. How should clinicians navigate the new MET-ALD classification in patients with mixed metabolic and alcohol etiologies?
So as I mentioned, we had a whole revamping of the nomenclature. So the umbrella term now is steatotic liver disease, which essentially means that there's fat in the liver. And as we know, the two most common causes of that are metabolic dysfunction or alcohol-associated injury. And so in the past, you had these two categories, and there was no existing category to account for somebody who had both risk factors. Now there's this new category called MET-ALD, acknowledging that the patient has metabolic dysfunction, but they also drink alcohol, but not in excess to the point that they would be categorized as having alcohol use disorder. And so technically that's the term. So they have metabolic dysfunction, they also drink alcohol, but not in excess. And so we have this new category. It can be difficult because the definitions for alcohol intake for this subcategory is in grams of alcohol, and it can be very difficult to ascertain that based on self-report. I think one of the other questions is, what is the role of PETH, if any, in this group? So PETH is a serum biomarker that you can send out. It's a blood test, and it'll give you an assessment of, like, the past 4 weeks of alcohol use. We use it, generally speaking, only in the transplant context. You could use it outside of that, but that gives you a kind of more objective assessment of average alcohol use for that individual. The reason we think it's important, and it's still emerging, this is a new category, is the thought is pathophysiologically, if you have both risk factors, the likelihood of you having more progressive disease is higher. And so we think that these people likely have a higher risk of advancing in their liver disease more substantially. So the take home is try to make sure, even if it's very clear that they have risk factors for MASLD, that you also do a very detailed alcohol assessment, because they may not just have MASLD, they may be in this overlap category.
Great. Well, that brings us to the end of our time together. I'd like to thank my colleagues, Carolyn Legaspi, nurse practitioner, and Dr. Monica Tinkopa, for your expertise and insights today. For additional resources, please visit the Liver Disease Hub at cmeoutfitters.com. Thank you, and I hope you have a great ACP meeting.
Thank you.